Dude, that is a fucking mega dong.
Scholars and Shots is a podcast featuring grown-ass adults getting drunk and nerding out over scholarly stuff.
I'm gonna bring you your scholars and shots. A bunch of knowledge that rocks.
There will be drinking, there will be lecturing, scholars. And there will be a steadily increasing number of F-bombs as the episode progresses. This is a podcast for adults, so parental guidance is suggested. Cheers!
All right, welcome to episode 3 of Scholars and Shots. I'm your host, Charlie, and with me as always is Brandy, my emotional support companion.
Good evening.
All right, featuring the absolutely brilliant and talented, now, can I call you a doctor now?
Yeah.
Dr. Kevin, hold on, I practiced. Hold on. Impelizzeri?
Perfect.
Yes!
Marvelous.
Yes! Okay. All right, so Dr., can I call you Dr. Kevin?
That's fine.
I'm sure that's going to, if that's how hard it was when I'm still sober, then I'm sure it's going to get harder later. First and foremost, congratulations, dude.
Thank you.
Yeah, congrats.
Thank you very much.
Defenses are the most terrifying things ever.
It was funny going into it. I was trying to think about which of my members of my committee I was most terrified of. My material culture expert, the technology history expert, the business history expert, or the actual video game history expert.
Oh, God. That is tough, man.
Do they all treat you pretty well? Or?
No, I mean, I'm here. So that counts for something. I keep playing it back in my head. It's like, well, I'm like, okay, well, I could have answered this question this way, but I keep going back to it's like, I'm here. I did it.
But you did it.
You did it.
I did it. Yeah. I did it.
Yay. Awesome.
Yeah, what's your background there? You look like you have a bar in your house or something.
That's So yeah, my partner set up we bought our house a couple of years ago, and we set up an industrial looking like basement bar.
Nice.
I like it. Awesome.
Which we call it the Scarlet Underground. but yeah, it's one of those things like we tried to see if we could build a bar on the cheap. And so we kind of got little things at like yard sales, and like we built a bar out of like a kitchen island that I found at like a home goods type store.
Oh, cool.
Nice.
Yeah, got it for like $100, put like a lacquer on it. I actually put together a resin surface.
Oh, wow.
And my partner works at a library.
Mm-hmm.
And so she printed out a map from, I think it's a De Medici, like a Renaissance era map.
Oh, cool.
And it's in the Mediterranean. So we put that on the surface, covered in like Mod Podge. And then I sealed it in resin. So it looks pretty cool.
Wow. You guys are pretty handy.
That is awesome, dude.
I could tell myself if the whole dissertation thing didn't work out, I should probably know some kind of trade.
Yeah, hell yeah. That sounds
good. Good to
like
have a backup.
Oh, yeah. You always got to have like 2 or 3 of those. So,
side hustle.
Yeah, no one ever died of an overabundance of skills.
Yeah, it's just you need a side hustle, and then you need a side hustle for your side hustle, you know?
Oh, right. God. Yeah, especially nowadays. All right. So, just to tell you a little bit about how things are going to go, we're basically just going to start drinking and talking about things like your bar. One of the things that I really like about this podcast is being able to kind of talk to academics and scholars about things that make us aware that they are more than just their study, you know, they're more than just their research area.
Sure.
And so we're going to just ask bullshit random questions about stuff. And I cannot do shots because the last podcast,
you got a little sideways.
I teleported. I remember taking the last shot, and then all of a sudden, I remember waking up in my bed, and it was light the next day, and I was like, oh, shit. I haven't blacked out in like 10 years. I didn't remember anything. At one point during the night, my husband, at my request, recorded me vomiting into a bucket and
oh man,
and lecturing to the bucket. And he was like, do you want to hear it? And I was like, no.
Oh my dear Lord.
Sit on that one for a few more weeks.
So I am drinking, I'm going to be drinking lame ass seltzer water too tonight because I'll get full before I start drinking everything else in the house.
Mm.
That's the plan. By the way, what are you drinking? How's your tolerance and everything?
I've got a pretty decent tolerance. I'm starting out with, because I am very, very basic, I'm starting out with a cheap black velvet whiskey. If it gets to the point where I hit my limit, because I'm pretty good about knowing my limits.
Oh, good. I'm not.
I've got,
that makes one of us.
I've got some low ABVers behind me, so I might switch to Lion's Head. And just in case if all else fails, I've been staying hydrated today, so I got some water too.
Dude, you got it all worked out. You would think we would have a better plan than that.
Hey,
given that we've done it a few times,
practically still in its beta phase, really.
Really, very beta.
I'd like to think that if nothing else, most graduate students are seasoned drinkers, especially us more advanced ones. You know.
Oh God, yeah. Totally. I mean, what else do you get out of college aside from that?
Yeah.
So I was gonna be drinking some of that, like Truly or White Claw or whatever, out of solidarity, because you mentioned that you were gonna drink that. So I got some like fancy hipster versions of that. It was like hard agua fresca
some,
you know, little brewery, or I don't even know, frescary in San Francisco. I drank it all last night. So now I was just like, fuck yeah, Friday. We're gonna hit the hibiscus. So I'm just gonna stick to my usual like shitty rosé today.
There you go.
That sounds like a plan. Well, I do want to point out, because this does hurt me a little bit, that I'm drinking this just so that this podcast doesn't make me like enormously fat. I would not choose to drink the seltzer. That is not my drink of choice, but you know.
If you don't mind me asking, what is your typical drink of choice?
Right, lately it's been Gozes. Just love a sour beer. Love it, love it, love it. But anything that's not too hoppy, unless it's really cold outside, and then I might go for an IPA.
Yeah, okay. Winter's coming. You might have to replace the Gozas with I don't know.
I don't bourbon. Know. I'm so excited. But I know.
My
I don't.
Suggestion.
I have to stay away from the liquor for a while. that shit was scary. It's like, oh my God.
Do we do like an inaugural shot and then we go, or
yes.
Do we do it at?
Because we are awkward as hell until we get a couple shots in us at least. So
you know, I'm going to mute my mic for a second and then just go grab a glass of wine, because I actually forgot to pour my drink. All right. I will be right back.
Not like it's an important part of the podcast or anything.
Right. But. It's not like what we're doing.
It is what it is. All right. Cheers. I went ahead and I drank already.
Microphone got in the way for a second there.
That's all right.
I'm sure that's going to become more of an issue as we get into the later rounds.
Right.
Can you guys hear it?
Fatality.
Yeah.
Marvelous.
Yes. I created a little soundboard. All right.
I'm excited. I really am.
I know. I envy Charlie's techie skills, because I lack them entirely.
I had a misspent youth. Very misspent. I spent a lot of time inside learning HTML.
That's a good skill.
You know, like it was a good skill. It served me sort of well, but it was, you know, I was 14. Everybody else was like going out and partying, and I was, you know.
Once you get into the working world, and you there's certain jobs, like if you say you know HTML, you become a wizard. Like I've worked a lot in museums, and oftentimes you get to the point where if you have a little bit of technical experience, people think that you're like you're the tech guy from like Hackers or something. You know, you're decrypting the mainframe.
See, usually in my experience, they're like, oh, you can do this? Let me give you 3 hours of work that I don't realize actually takes 3 freaking hours. And not paying extra for it. So that's been
that
my
too.
Right. It's like being the tall person in the grocery store.
Oh yeah, she's very, very, very tall. Like, how tall are you?
6'1".
Yeah. So she grabs stuff for me all the time whenever we're hanging out. All right. So I happen to notice that you are the assistant director of the Karabatz Junior Fellows Program and a curriculum director at the College of Physics or Physicians of Philadelphia.
Yep, that's it.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah, yeah. That's a lot.
Most people know us from the Mütter Museum.
That's what I was getting ready to ask you.
That's got to have some seriously crazy stuff in there.
Oh, that if those walls could talk.
Oh my God. Oh,
dude. I have so many morbid questions.
I know, right? We were like texting a little bit about this before. Like, oh my gosh, in the Mütter Museum.
Yeah, I said, can you fucking believe this? I have so many questions. I guess I want to kind of start with that. First of all, what does that entail? You say on your profile that you're a museum professional by day and a video game scholar by night, historian by night. So what does it entail? What is your job like?
Sure. So going backwards a little bit with that, when I was getting into my doctoral program, I really started looking, because I'd always wanted to be in academia. I wanted to be a professor. And then I started seeing how bad the job market is. And I can't remember which article was in the Chronicle of Higher Education, because there have been numerous doomsaying articles in the Chronicle that says something along the lines that 75% of the academic workforce was adjunct.
Oh, geez. And
I decided I wasn't having any of that. So I was like, fortunately, in my doctoral program, they also have a great museum studies program.
Ooh.
And so along the way, at the advice of my advisor, who was the director of the program, said you should get a museum studies certificate along the way. So I learned a lot about that and eventually found the work there. But let's go into the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. So I run the College of Physicians, in addition to the Mooner Museum of the College of Physicians, part of the organization's mission is to advance the cause of health, which involves not just having a network of researchers and physicians and things, but we do tons of public health programming. And with that, we do four high school, summer, and after-school youth programs.
Ooh.
So the one I'm responsible for is the Carabas Junior Fellows Program. And basically, it's a three-year summer and after-school program for Philadelphia high school students from underserved communities who are interested in becoming physicians.
Oh, wow.
And so we introduce them to... Because the college is not like a university. It's more a college like a fraternal organization.
Okay.
So as a result, we have members. I think we've got 1,100 members right now, and they represent all different fields of medicine. So we bring some of them in, and they talk to our students. We meet once a week during the school year for pretty much 3 years. They come in as sophomores, and they're through their senior year. And fellows talk about their career paths. They talk about different fields in healthcare. We teach them about medicine. We teach them about science. We do hands-on projects. My students just finished an exhibit on cancer biology, which we just opened at the Mooner Museum, which I had to install the day before I defended.
Oh, no!
So I have a wonderful set of coworkers, but I had to go in. Who were willing to let me take a couple days off to do the defense, but I had to go in and install the exhibit.
Oh,
but
wow.
it was a project my students did over the course of about 6 months.
Wow.
We also help them with college prep, and we talk about subjects that we think they're going to find interesting. I've had that interesting pivot from being someone who worked in the humanities to kind of becoming a STEM educator.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
So I've gotten to do research on stuff like antibiotic resistance. We just opened a huge new exhibit on the 1918 influenza pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
And so... at the very least, it's been an opportunity to learn a lot about a lot of really cool things and meet a lot of great people. When I started a week after what was then the fourth cohort of the program. We bring in a new cohort every 2 years. They graduated 3 years ago. We had 22. We had 22 students. All of them graduated from high school. All but two of them moved on to college. The other two kind of did other things instead of just traditional college. Mm-hmm. The fifth cohort, which I recruited, I helped recruit, they'll be graduating in June. And then we just brought in a new cohort. And so we've been doing this for 10 years now. We've had about 110 students in the whole program. And it's been exciting. It's been really fun. It's been really rewarding. And it's been kind of a way to use my research skills. And I've always loved teaching, and I've always loved interacting with the public. It's given me a great opportunity to do that stuff, and I've been extremely fortunate. I love my coworkers. It's a really cool place. If you're ever in Philadelphia, I really recommend checking it out. There's no place like it.
I've already made plans, and I'm definitely getting in touch with you first.
Absolutely.
That's going to be awesome. That sounds so great. I mean, the part about being able to kind of see what good you're doing, you know, I'm assuming you got to keep a lot of documents and stuff like that to keep track of everything for the funders and stuff.
Mm.
So you can easily sort of track, like, this is the impact I'm making in the world. That is awesome. Dude.
It feels pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a sucker for, pandemic and epidemic like stories and shit like that. Like, Ebola was like kind of a big when we were younger. So, cause I did see, you know, you graduated 2 years after we did.
Mm-hmm.
So we're around the same age. So yeah, I was going somewhere with that, but I forgot where. So, you know,
yeah. What's the craziest exhibit that you guys have?
Ooh, so again, that's a tough question because so the Mooner Museum is kind of arranged in a very old style of museums called the Cabinet of Curiosities. So basically this goes back, it dates back to, I want to say 15, 1600s when museums were just basically places for rich people to put their stuff and show what cool stuff they have.
Yeah.
And so the Mooner, when it opened in the 1860s, kind of kept that idea. And so a lot of it is, we've had some more modern exhibits. So for example, that 1918 flu pandemic, which opened about 2 weeks ago, is an example of that. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, you're going to see things in cases that are kind of loosely arranged by like discipline of medicine.
Okay.
So there are a couple top ones I can think of. One is there's a woman on display we call the Soap Lady.
Okay.
So the Soap Lady was found in, I'm going to get the date wrong, I believe in the 1880s as part of a public works project here in Philadelphia, which they uncovered a mass grave, and they found a male and a female body that were basically covered in like this soapy substance.
Uh-huh.
It's a material they call adipocere, which can happen if a body is buried under very specific chemical circumstances. If the soil has a certain level of alkalinity, if it has a certain degree of moisture, and if the body has a certain degree of body fat, that could cause a chemical change where basically they start to what they call saponify. They turn to soap, basically.
Wow. Okay.
So these are the words you learn when you're becoming an your historian.
Yeah.
And so it was discovered, it was brought to the Philadelphia Medical Examiner's office, and a guy who was a member of the organization, a guy named Joseph Leidy, who's a pretty noteworthy Philadelphia figure. He, I believe, was educated at the University of Pennsylvania. He was the first curator and librarian of the Academy of Natural Sciences of Philadelphia. There's actually a big statue of him out in front of it because he was really involved in paleontology.
Ooh. Okay.
And he was also a fellow of the College. He was also the first president of this group called the Reidner Free Institute of Science, another great small natural history museum in Philadelphia. And he took interest in this particular set of specimens because it was just what we call the Soap Lady and the Soap Man.
Mm-hmm.
And he convinced a gentleman to go to the medical examiner's office under the auspices that this guy was recovering his, I think it was his grandparents, and basically acquired these bodies this way. And we have a receipt paid to the order for about $7 for this guy to get these bodies.
Nice. Well, wow. 19th century trickery. Yeah, I like it.
Not without a little bit of skullduggery about that. And one of them became part of the collection at the College of Physicians. The other is part of the Smithsonian, which I don't believe they have on display anymore. But if you Google Soap Man, you'll find him.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
See, I'm still sitting here thinking, like, who was the first person that had to actually come up with the word saponify? I mean, it doesn't seem like there's like a whole lot of thought required in that one. Like, but I mean, where else could you possibly go? It's like, yeah, fuck it, saponify.
It still happens. I listened to a pretty wild stuff you missed in history class a while ago, which right when I started the job, because they did the Soap Lady, and they talked about how they'll still find saponified bodies.
Oh, wow.
I believe there was one in like the Czech Republic they found a couple of years ago or something.
Huh. So
if it's in the right conditions.
Yeah. Okay. Like congregated around like the right type of soil or something. Or
yeah. It's a weird set of circumstances. Yeah.
Okay. So what I want to know is there anything crazy at the Mooner Museum that is like not on display? Like what are the crazy things that you can't display for whatever reason? And follow-up question before you even get started. What are the reasons that you take things off display aside from, you know, running out of room?
All right. So I'll answer the second part first, because I have a great answer for the first one. We have on display about... Now, I know the curator will probably correct me. I think we have about 10% or a little less than 10% of the entire collection on display. And a large part of that is because of space. This is a small building. The building was the current home of the College of Physicians was built in 1909. And if you go to the place, it's fairly small. And as much as I love it, you could probably explore the entirety of the exhibit space in probably about an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Oh.
It's not terribly large. We actually just started, we're in the midst of a whole huge gallery expansion campaign where we're going to redesign parts of the building to add a whole bunch of new gallery space with part of the hope of having more stuff on display. So the answer to the first question, I'm actually looking this up real fast because I want to make sure that I don't get it wrong. So there is a thing that is in the museum, and it has been put on display on our Instagram, which is at Mutter Museum. So I don't know what animal this is, but I will tell you this, and I'll send you an image after we're all done here, that there is something that we don't put on display very much, and I'll only give you one word. It's called the Mega Dong.
Oh, nice. Well, funny you should say that, because I want to circle back around to the Soap Man real quick, because of course I did a Google image search as soon as you said, you know, to do so. The first thing that comes up is a handmade soap for adult, also says penis soap, dick, being sold on eBay for $15.84. And then you see images of the Soap Man.
By the Matrix, my goodness.
Wow.
Make sure your safe search is on, then I'd say for that.
Yeah.
But if you search Mutter Museum Mega Dong, you'll see what I'm talking about.
Writing that down.
There's a picture on Twitter with Margaret Cho holding this thing.
Well, the first thing that comes up in the predictive text for the search is Mutter Museum Mega Coin.
You want me to talk about that?
I guess you have to now.
Okay.
But I'm still searching Mega Dong.
I can totally talk about the Mutter Museum like all
Jude,
day long.
That is a fucking Mega Dong. Wow.
Yeah.
I love Google image search. Okay, so back to the mega colon.
Okay, so here's another big medical term I got to learn, and one of the marvels of being in museums. There's a condition known as congenital aganglionic megacolon.
Ooh, okay. Breaking that down etymologically in my mind, not pleasant.
Excuse me.
All right.
It's a lot of bubbles. I can't help it.
So they used to call it Hirschsprung's syndrome. Now it's more called megacolon. It's basically if a section of a person's colon that the nerves that pass waste through it, if they don't work properly, they can cause blockages. And those blockages over time can become pretty severe. They can cause distortions of the colon. They cause severe constipation, cause a great amount of pain. Right. Today, they're pretty easy to pick out just because if a baby doesn't have a bowel movement in the first couple of days, they know something's up.
Right.
And the way it's treated today is it's usually two sets of surgeries. One removes the section of the colon that doesn't work, and then they reattach the rest of it.
Okay.
And generally, if people have that surgery, they're fine. They end up being all right. But if you have cases where, say, access to medical care is not great, if you're having it in time periods when, say, surgery was extremely risky, either because surgical expertise was not very good, and there was a long period of medical history that was the case even in the United States, and when they didn't have things like perfected things like anesthesia, you would have people who would have to live with this kind of stuff. And there's a gentleman whose colon we have on display at the museum, while he was alive, he had severe pain from the severe constipation. His abdomen expanded and swelled out because of this. And during his life, he performed in a circus sideshow. I believe they called him the human windbag was the term they gave for him. He died relatively young and had not had a bowel movement in, I think, weeks.
Smell of that autopsy.
Yeah. We have a section of the colon on display. It's now stuffed with straw, but it is big and it's kind of like distorted. And if you'd like to take one of it home, we have a stuffed person of it.
Yes, I just noticed that because of course I just did a little Google image on that too. And there's like a little plush mega colon.
There is
that
a plush mega colon.
So
we have to put up like a GoFundMe for a field trip up there because I am so excited. All right. So the first part of the question is like, what's the weirdest thing? I think, if I'm remembering correctly, what's the weirdest thing that you don't have on display?
That was the Megadong.
Oh, the Megadong. Okay. So I'm guessing the reason you don't have that on display is because it's a dong.
I don't attempt to speak for our curator.
I don't make the rules. That could be it.
Fair enough. And I need you to say, love this. I need you to say Megadong one more time because the audio went all crazy. Just because I want to make sure, like, I can skip through a lot of other stuff and just like cut it, but that one I want it to be able to
loud
hear
and clear.
I can hear the blackmail coming eventually. but it's called
now
the,
you know our secrets.
It is the Megadong.
Nice.
So
the challenge is to say it without while keeping a straight face.
Yeah, not happening. I wonder why they went with dong.
Mega dong. How long do you have to keep a straight face? I think I did it for a second.
That's long enough.
All right, cool. Woo, cheers. All right, so let's get started talking about how you came to study what you came to study.
Sure.
You know, because I know you went from Willing Jennings Bryant to video games.
Yeah, so I've been playing video games pretty much all my life. I think my parents got an NES mostly against their better judgment, but they seemed to like them for when I was 5 years old, and I became obsessed with video games. I would play them at home. I'd play them over my friends and my cousin's house, and I slowly tried to pick up new systems as I got new generations. I still remember trying to save up money to get a Sega Genesis, and that was kind of a big deal when I was like 9 or 10 years old. When I got to college, I was like, I want to make video games. I'd love to be a game designer. So I figured that I needed a technical background. So I decided I was going to go into undergraduate as a computer science major. I did a year of prerequisites. I got through a year of calculus. First semester of my sophomore year, I took my first intro to computer science class. It was a Java programming class, and I could not connect to the material in any way. So there were a lot of things going against me. It was like, you know, I really started thinking, like, you know, this is not really what I want to do. But I'd always loved history. My father is a big history buff, really inspired a love of it. We used to go to museums. We've been going to museums with my family since I was a young kid. Mostly because I was one of those 5-year-olds who's obsessed with dinosaurs, so we go to dinosaur museums.
I mean, what normal 5-year-old isn't? I'm still obsessed with dinosaurs.
Yes, in an alternative timeline, I am definitely a paleontologist, for sure. For sure.
That's what I always told my grandma that I was going to be when I was like 5 years old. She was just like, what does that even mean?
Yeah, there was a stretch where I was like, I'm going to be a paleontologist. And,
oh, yeah.
But I decided, like, I really loved history. And so I became a history political science double major. I minored in English. And I was in an honors program there. So I decided my big honors project was going to be a research project. I researched the Scopes trial.
Ooh,
so
yes.
The anti-evolution trial from 1925. Mm-hmm. In which it was William Jennings Bryan, who at that point was a 3-time presidential candidate. He's kind of near the end of his career. He becomes the prosecutor for this case in Dayton, Tennessee, over the teaching of evolution. His counterpart's like the most famous defense attorney at the time, getting him Clarence Darrow. And so the story is really cool. Research Bryan's involvement in that, and it became my undergraduate thesis. And thought this was amazing. I got to go to the Library of Congress. I got to do a lot of really great research. If there's time, I've got a story about that too. But
definitely.
There's time. Tell it. Go ahead.
Sure, all night. Or here as long as you want to be.
Sure. I went to the Library of Congress when it was my senior year of college. And so I went down to the, I wanted to go to the library. I went down to do research in the Library of Congress in the William Jennings Bryan papers. My mother was terrified about me going to DC on my own. So she insisted my dad go with me. So he and I got a motel just outside of DC. And it's a good thing he went, because when I went there, I took the metro, took a cab to get out to the Library of Congress. And I was, I believe I was 20 at the time, and they wouldn't let me in by myself.
What?
And what? I had it explained to me when I got there. It says, we can't have you come here unless you have written permission from your professor. But thankfully, my father came with me, so I was basically his escort to go to the Library of Congress. Which he loved. Again, my dad loves history. We went through the William Jennings Bryan papers to research his involvement. And we're getting starstruck. It's like, who else is going to get starstruck over seeing Warren Harding writing a letter to a guy, you know?
Oh, my God. I talk about Warren Harding every year in my class when I'm talking about presidential sex scandals. Because he wrote really dirty, dirty, dirty letters.
Did he have a megadong?
Well, I don't know. But if he did, he named it Jerry. So there's that.
Good to know.
Did you ever hear the story, the rumor that came out? This came out a couple of years after Harding died, that the rumor was that Mrs. Harding poisoned him.
This is
totally unproven. It's totally unproven. He had a heart condition, died of a heart embolism, I believe it was. But there was a scandalous rumor because his affairs were fairly well known. And the story was that his wife found out about this and she poisoned him.
That's hilarious. Well, you know, I do tell my students this story about how he had a thing for having sex in janitorial closets or whatever, and the Secret Service ran block for him because his wife was looking for him.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah.
There's a I'm gonna I'm going to botch the name and I might look it up. A guy wrote the book, The Perils of Prosperity, and he had this quotation from Warren Harding that it said, now Warren Harding had a notoriously corrupt cabinet and like everybody's involved in some shady stuff. And supposedly he said to someone, he's like, I'm not worried about my enemies. It's my goddamn friends that are keeping me up at night.
Spoken like a true politician.
Spoken like a true fucking corrupt ass politician for sure.
Right.
With a penis named Jerry.
With a penis named Jerry.
Okay.
Why Jerry?
I don't know. But he wrote very, very in-depth, dirty, dirty, dirty letters, and his mistress published all of them after his death.
Man, oh man.
Jerry.
So to go back with all this sordid story led us to, so I was really excited about doing that kind of research, and so I decided, you know, I'm going to try to go for a PhD in history. Applied to a bunch of programs, ended up getting accepted in a master's program at the University of Delaware, and while I was there, I kind of started out in more history. Was mostly the history I was exposed to when I was in undergraduate was the traditional stuff, battles, presidents, you know, dead white dudes. And
yeah.
And so fortunately, we have Delaware is a great history program. One of my first grad courses was had the most amazing title. So I had to do this one. It was called Death, Disease, and the Body in American Life.
Ooh.
So I
that
read a
sounds
whole,
awesome.
It was a great class. It was taught by Carol Haber, who has since moved on to Tulane University. And we did a lot about perceptions of disease and death. I got to read books about illegal body trafficking in Victorian America. We talked about cholera epidemics. It was a really cool thing, and I got to learn about that. But long story short, I got to my end of my master's program, and I decided, you know, I was going to try still for a PhD. And he's like, you know what? I didn't know if I was going to get in. I applied to a bunch of PhD programs. I said, you know what? This might be the last research paper I ever write. Like, I might have to get, like, a real job. So I decided I have always wanted to research video games. So let's do it. I didn't know if there was anything out there. I didn't know if there were any good source material. I just dove in. And I found tons of cool stuff. At the time, most of it was being done by fans. Because when I did this, this was back in 2000 and 2009. And, like, they're really, like, The Strong was still kind of getting off the ground. The International Center for the History of Electronic Games up in New York. There wasn't really this huge archive. Push to preserve this stuff, but tons of fans had been doing that for years, where they had just been keeping their collections and scanning and digitizing and putting stuff up for free online. This was things like game magazines, some internal documents. People were dumping the ROMs for the games themselves and distributing them online. And I found tons of cool stuff. And Delaware, fortunately, decided to keep me on as a doctoral candidate. And I decided to make that my dissertation.
That is awesome.
And found lots of cool stuff. And over the years, you saw more of an administrative and like institutional interest in preserving games, and like more materials got preserved. The Strong Museum's do wonderful work. There's the Computer History Museum over in California. There's the new Video Game Museum in Frisco, Texas. The Smithsonian's been doing great work. And so along the way, people started talking about this more, and along the way, we have a lot more great scholars. And so I was happy to be able to do something in something like that. I felt really fortunate.
That's super cool. So how many people like are studying video games right now?
Quite a few now. A lot more than there were about 10 years ago when I started looking into this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it kind of makes sense though, because it's like people of our generation, right?
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, was there like a massive spike after, like when, was there a spike after people got their knickers in a twist about about the violence and whatnot?
There was a huge spike in psychology.
Okay, but not as a field in its own at all. It was mostly just being absorbed into other fields.
So most of the early, if we're talking about history, like historical analysis of games, mm-hmm. The first people to really do it were journalists.
Okay.
They were mostly trying to figure out, okay, so the first journalistic like accounts of games are like, there's a guy named Scott Cohen who wrote a history of Atari in 1984. Mm-hmm. And it was more like his and some of the other ones that followed were like, okay, why is this so popular all of a sudden? we need to figure out what these kids are into. And so he wrote a book called Zap, The Rise and Fall of Atari. A guy named David Sheff did a book on Nintendo a couple years after him. You really don't see this kind of sort of scholarly analysis of games up until mm-hmm. about the turn of the millennium.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you still saw the journalistic histories are like, okay, this medium is big and it's explosive and everybody's making money off it or everybody's playing it. And but it wasn't until a couple of years ago that you started seeing people who kind of grew up with games, started taking it seriously as a field of study, mm-hmm. And started doing research works on it. Like there are a couple of really great scholars in it right now. For example, there's a journal that just got published, I believe, in July called ROM Chips, and they put it together sort of the first peer-reviewed scholarly scholarly journals specifically focus on game history.
That's cool.
There've been a couple on games and culture. There's been a couple on game studies, but now they're focusing on sort of a historical, critical, and like archivally based research methodology. Mm-hmm. And that's new. That came out only a few months ago.
Oh, wow.
Oh, okay. Wow.
But they're also
at the tip of the spear. You're the vanguard for this.
A field emerged while I was doing this.
Well, that's awesome. You were ahead of the curve.
Yeah, blazing trails, man.
I can't take any credit for that because there are a lot of great people who are doing stuff now who already have books and are publishing and talking about this.
I'm just trying to give you props, dude. Like,
I appreciate that.
Yeah, it was awesome. Nice.
All right, good time. Excuse
me. So let's talk about your favorite video games then.
Yes.
All right. Yeah. So Charlie had sent me a question asking what my favorite video game was, and that is an extremely hard question for me.
It is like 10, I think.
So I have an insufferably long list of games, and I'm one of those people that over the years I've like, okay, what are my top 100 games? And I have thought seriously about putting together a ranking of all of them, but I gave you 10 of them.
Mm-hmm. I was just glad that Super Mario 3 was on there because, like, shamefully, I have to admit that I was just never really into video games that much. Like, I was like addict level fucking obsessed with Super Mario 3. And it got to the point where I would have to give up a system, right? And then I got a PlayStation 2 much later, and then was like so into the Marvel ones that I had to like give up the system. So it's just like I have these very like brief windows of just like all out, all in, whatever you want to say.
Okay.
Yeah, I went straight from like fucking NES to Vice City, and I'm pretty obsessed with them now. But yeah, like, you know, one of the things that I noticed in a lot of your research that you kept pointing out is that their targeting of it used to be family. You know, and then all of a sudden it was young dudes who are lonely and depressed. And that was like the marketing change. And I was like, you know, fuck that. Cause like, I love video games now. And they're only now just starting to like make video games that recognize that it's not just young dudes who are lonely and shit. That's fucking it.
I feel like you need to have Jess Williamson on here because he would talk about that better than I could. So he's a guy who's doing research now on, he calls it game advertising to adolescence. So this is his handle on Twitter is Decaffeinated Jedi.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I've seen him. Okay, yeah.
He's awesome. He does, right now he's doing research on video game advertising in the 90s and 2000s. So he kind of does it like beyond what I talk about. And you get to see the kind of stuff they put in these fucking ads. And like, what I love about gaming now is that like, because it's not just about a couple of specific systems and you don't need big publishers, and because the internet is what it is that like now you can cater to audiences that are beyond like by the time they get to the 90s, they are like all in for Boys.
Yeah.
And like part of what got me into this research was like starting to think reflexively about like, it's like, I've loved video games since I was 5 years old. Like I said, it's like, why me? Why have I connected? Like, for example, my sister played video games with me when I was that age.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was a kid, I could not play Super Mario Bros. 3 unless I included my little sister.
My dad would like jump in on Super Mario. He'd be one of those people with a controller, and then like his whole body would be like,
oh, was he like the old, was he like the Kotaku used to do a great segment, used to be called This Week in Fake Gaming. And it was like stock footage and like videos of people pretending to play video games where they're like doing all the big actions and they're moving back and forth. And like, I've been playing video games for like 30 years. I've never really done that very much in games. I've thrown controllers. I've definitely done that.
Because it's like, fuck this shit. Yeah, you're mad.
You'd be surprised at the games that it's funny because I've been playing this for a long time. The only ones that really make me do sports games, and like particularly Madden. And I have a long love hate relationship with Madden. And where like I kind of like sports, but I have like a weird fantasy thing with sports. So like I only like sports games if I can make my own teams.
Fair enough.
I have the only Madden game I play is Madden NFL 07, which was the last game they really had created a team. And so like I had a long save that I did for a while where I just substituted all 32 teams for made up teams.
That's awesome.
I'm doing made up fantasy land here.
Nice.
But yeah,
which is the best?
Because like I don't like after one season, it's all fiction anyway.
That's true.
but going back to it, like this, I kind of tried to think about like what, why is it that I played for so long and why am I still playing? Whereas like my sister, like she got like a real job and like got a family and stuff and doesn't spend all of her time thinking about video games like I do. And like why that happened. And you begin to see that transition. You kind of start seeing that transition by about the time Nintendo becomes a console developer. And so Nintendo releases the NES in, they kind of release the NES gradually. I guess we're getting into lecture now, which is fine. Okay.
You can just go ahead and do it. Let's just do it.
So I'll start here. And like,
sounds great.
Nintendo releases the NES in, they started out, again, connection to where I am. They released the NES first on a test market in the greater New York area. In 1985.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they started with a test market. And some of that was important because I'll skip a little bit further back then. So the market, console gaming and video games in general were really huge in the early 80s. And like everybody was playing them.
Atari.
Yeah, Atari, the 2600. Mm-hmm. The 2600 was the biggest system. It sold like 10 million units. Atari controlled about 80% of the market in like 1982. And then by 1984, it had all come crashing down. There were a lot of reasons. So like part of the reason was Atari was kind of a victim of their own success. They were one of those companies where it's like, okay, we are printing money. It's like the typical like Wolf of Wall Street kind of story. We are printing money. We can do whatever we want. We are fucking gods. We are going to do this. And then they made a lot of really bad decisions. So part of it was that in the 70s, to get the 2600 released, the company didn't have enough money to do it. So they got Warner to buy them. So Warner Communications, a big media conglomerate, they come in, they buy Atari. And then a kind of a new corporate culture came into Atari. And like, there are wacky stories about what Atari was like in the late 70s, where like, it was like, apparently like the assembly plants just reeked of weed. They just pulled guys off the sheet to make a street to make Atari games. There's stuff about like, if arcade consoles weren't selling well, they would put them up on the roof and just shove them off the roof.
Nice.
Oh,
and like lots of weird wacky stuff there. And then when Warner came in, they're like, we could either run this as a business. And so they got a more of a corporate culture, and a lot of guys left.
I don't blame them.
And the first guys to leave were there were four programmers who were sick of, because Atari was notorious about like, we're not going to have the names of our developers. We're not going to give anybody any credit. We're not going to give anybody royalty rights. Atari is Atari, and that's it. And so a bunch of guys, there was Steve Cartwright, and I'm going to look it up just because I'm going to forget the names. They leave, there are four of them, and they leave and they form their own company. It's called Activision. So Activision gets formed as the first third-party company for video games. They are Steve Cartwright, David Crane, Larry Kaplan, Alan Miller, and Bob Whitehead. Sorry. Bob Whitehead.
I'm shit at names, so you don't have to apologize.
It that's one of those things that like people who don't work in history know, is that historians don't know facts or dates. And we always have to look up everything.
Oh, God bless.
Oh, the most terrifying thing for a historian is someone quizzing you on something.
That's why I don't make my students remember dates. I always tell them, I was like, we got books to look that shit up. So
when I taught undergrads, I never had the memorized dates. They form Activision, and the story goes that I've never been able to verify this. Supposedly, that they picked the name Activision because it would appear first in a phone book before Atari.
That's brilliant.
And so
when phone books were a thing.
Yeah.
Right?
And so Atari wanted to sue them into oblivion, and like, we don't want to deal with them. They were supposedly sending out stuff that like, okay, if you put an Atari cartridge in your VCS, it's going to break the hell out of it. So they eventually go through courts, and eventually they settle, and Activision becomes officially the first third-party company. And then what that did was kind of give the green light to a bunch of people to form their own companies that would make games for the Atari 2600. They called it the 2600 beginning about 1982, but we'll call it for that because most people know what it is at.
Yeah.
So a bunch more people left Atari. They formed their own companies. There's companies like Games by Apollo was one. Darn it, what was that? Imagic was another. And then a bunch of people realized, it's like, you know what? We can make cartridges fairly easy for the Atari 2600. And it became like the Wild West. Everybody was making stuff for the Atari. More established media companies started making their own companies. 20th Century Fox had a game company called Games of the Century. CBS made its own company called CBS Electronics. It was actually, speaking of Madden, my love-hate relationship with Madden football. they originally only made sports games, and their sponsor, the spokesman, was John Madden. About five or six years before Madden NFL, Madden football was a thing. Madden was a sponsor for them. There were games that like people made for like if you put in like if you send like proofs of purchase and you mailed them in. So for example, there was a game that you know this is before my time. So the chuck wagon from Purina. There were these commercials where this chuck wagon would go through like a kitchen and a dog would chase it.
Yes.
There was a game of that.
What? Really?
Look up chasing the chuck wagon.
Oh my god, I'm so looking that up.
Everybody made games for Atari.
Chuck wagon. Oh my god. Paperboy. I don't remember chasing the chuck wagon. What the fuck?
Coca-Cola made a game that was just a knockoff of Space Invaders, where instead of Space Invaders, it was the letters PEPSI for the things that destroyed.
Pepsi's still better.
Everybody started making games for Atari, and like on top of that, there were like a bunch of other consoles that tried to compete with them. There was the North American Philips of the Odyssey 2. There was Mattel with the Intellivision. Eventually, Coleco in 1981 releases the ColecoVision. There was the Bally Professional Arcade released by Bally in 1978. There was a ton of systems.
Yeah.
And they're competing for shelf space. And like Atari by 1981 is still the biggest company, but it's getting crowded now. So they start so they're losing a lot of people. Like I said, there's that brain drain. A lot of people form their own companies. They start suing the shit out of people. But 1981 was an extremely litigious year for Atari. They sued everybody. They sued North American Philips because they made a game that was a knockoff of Pac-Man called Casey Munchkin. Because at the time, they got an exclusive deal with Bally Midway to release a version of Pac-Man. And they sued Coleco because Coleco made an attachment for the ColecoVision that would run Atari 2600 games, which they eventually had to, they cut a deal with them. Bally, or Astrocade, which was a company that released this system called the Astrocade, sued them for patent infringement. But on top of that, Atari was suing everybody. A lot of people are starting to leave the company. They're not liking the corporate culture there. They're overproducing because Atari decided they wanted to overmanufacture people into oblivion. So like they're sending a bunch of stuff to retailers, and retailers are like, there's too much stuff here, so we're sending it back to them. And meanwhile, they're kind of lying to their investors. So in 82, the market got really crowded. And like I said, Atari is trying to overproduce and they're trying to sue everybody. And they're also kind of lying about how well they're doing. So in the second quarter of 82, Warner had, I think they were at about, they had huge profits, these huge gains. And they assumed that they were just going to continue to grow up and up and up. So they get to December 8th, 1982. And before that, Atari had also, in addition to the brain drain, in addition to the market getting bigger, in addition to suing everybody, they'd also tried to release a whole new system. They tried to release a system called the 5200, and they marketed it as the super system. And a lot of consumers got concerned because, okay, we've been buying a lot of Atari. We've been buying a lot of 2600 games. So what you're saying is you're going to release a whole new system, and we're going to have to buy a whole new set of software for that. Because one thing the video game market did not have in 82 that has now is planned obsolescence. And so you have a bunch of people who are saying like, okay, I've got a whole bunch of 2600 games. What the hell am I supposed to do with these things with the 5200? And they kind of made really vague promises for a while. Oh, we'll make an adapter for the 5200. They did eventually, but not enough to save the 5200. And it failed for a bunch of other reasons too, but if I were to speculate, is like people just liked what they had. All of that culminated on December the 8th, 1982. Warner, who was the parent company of Atari, who at that point was making most of their money through Atari, had to scale back their earnings estimate. And they were still going to make a profit, but it was going to make a significantly smaller profit than they did. And what it did is it scared the shit out of investors. And their stock price tumbled about 16.75 points in a matter of hours.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
And that's back when 16 points was like a big fucking deal.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's a big deal now, but...
They tumbled quickly.
Like, I mean, what year was that again?
That was in 82, December 8th, 1982.
Jesus Christ. They only had like 6,000 points or maybe even less than that shit. So that's a big deal.
So their stock tumbled. A bunch of companies, so like Imagic I mentioned before, which is a bunch of former Atari developers, yeah. they were gonna go public. They stopped trying to go public. Mattel took their stock off the market for a day to stop people from selling them.
What?
The Wall Street Journal had the most amazing line about this. And it was something, I'm paraphrasing part of this. The first one was like, for all those people who are invested in consumer electronics, December 8th was the day Warner Communications stole Christmas.
Nice.
It was an astonishing change from what they had been expecting. And this is kind of where the market starts to turn. And like it had already gotten crowded by the end of the year. So a couple weeks later, a couple of companies declared bankruptcy. The first was this company called Astrocade. So Astrocade had a system called the Bally Professional Arcade. Astrocade's a funny company. So Astrocade's funny because they really thought they could compete with Atari. They beginning in February 1982, they started a $10 million advertising campaign directly targeting against Atari.
Wait, what year was this? I'm sorry.
This was in 1982.
Okay, so $10 million advertising campaign is pretty fucking significant.
Yeah, a year, about 6 months before, a writer for the Chicago Tribune called Astrovision the company to watch for in terms of investments. And that same writer wrote in October of 1982, this company was basically insolvent with a negative net worth of $1 million.
Oh,
wow.
Aside from Atari's misfortunes, this company was not terribly well managed. And so when they tank in 1982, it wasn't unexpected. But then by 1983, people were like, you know, we need to get the hell out of video game systems and make computers instead. And a whole bunch of companies start making their own computer systems instead. Mm-hmm. So like Mattel, which made the Intellivision, made a system called the Aquarius. And Coleco, which made the ColecoVision, made a system called the Atom. And they're like, you know, we're going to get involved in low-price computer systems. If we're talking about console wars, it was scorched earth in the early 80s because you had Atari. Now, first off, in terms of console wars, there was a winner. Atari won, like hands down. They had 80% of the market in 82. No question.
In the early 80s.
In the early 80s, yeah. Oh, this is the last high point of Atari.
Okay.
So, like I said, they're making a lot of bad decisions. The day at Warner Communications stole Christmas, and so while this is happening, there was a growing market for home computers. Now, there was a push beginning in the early 80s. There were kind of two computer markets. There was what you called your personal computer market and your home computer market. PCs were more your higher end computers. They ran about $700-$800 and up. They were more for like big or multifunctional stuff. You could use them for business. You can use them for home. And then there was also this growing market of what they called home computers, which were like low-cost, low-end computers that were kind of for a more general audience. They were for people who didn't really use computers for technical reasons.
Right.
And that got so cutthroat. The biggest markets in the early 80s, there was IBM, which eventually released the PC and the PC Junior and all that, although they marketed more for the higher-end stuff. And then there was Commodore. There was the VIC-20 and then the Commodore 64.
I haven't even thought of Commodore in years.
Right?
So Commodore was founded by a guy named Jack Tramiel. And Jack Tramiel, T-R-A-M-I-E-L, Tramiel.
You're a good man spelling that for me. Yeah.
I may be butchering the name. I was calling Tramiel. I think also Tramiel is acceptable. So anyway, so you got like these home computer market and you got your PC market. And the two biggest companies initially in the early 80s are Commodore, founded by a guy named Jack Tramiel, and Texas Instruments. Mm-hmm. And TI and Commodore had a long history. They had they developed calculators around the same
time. Fucking calculators.
TI, they're still around, those TI calculators, but
I used to do all kinds of horrible things with those calculators.
Right, you could draw all sorts of crazy. Yeah.
I had friends in high school who learned how to program on those things. There was at least one guy I knew. He figured out how to do like SimCity kind of stuff on
Jesus
his TI.
Christ.
Oh, that's amazing.
My brain just does not work like that.
Yeah, me either. That's why I got out of computer science and I'm doing this thing now. But again, that's led me on this sordid trail that I've been on.
I just keep thinking about 1996. Like, that's when we got the computer. And all I remember is like Encarta and AOL and Duke Nukem.
I, My family had AOL for an obscene amount of time.
And then it took like 10 minutes to log in.
Oh, they'll never appreciate it. This is the millennial generation gap, because they will never appreciate what we went through to get that internet. 10 miles to school today on our hands and knees, nothing. We had to wait forever for those.
Okay, yeah. So like my 2-year-old daughter, when she was like 9 months old, my daughter figured out that she would have to like take thumb, put it on the phone to unlock it so that she could watch some like Baby Shark video or, you know, like whatever. Like, and then she'll like look at our giant TV and like be like all touching the screen and like trying to like move shit on the TV. Like, yeah, just the whole Jesus.
I still live, to your point, Brandy, I work in museums now, and I still live in terror that some middle schooler is going to come in and break our touch screens and put like porn or something on there. I have a genuine fear that someone's going to fuck up our shit with that stuff, you know?
Terrified, but also it'd be kind of funny, maybe.
You have to promise me, Dr. Kevin, if that ever happens, please let me know. I won't tell anybody. I just want to know. That's amazing.
Thank you for listening and getting 3 sheets windward with us. Thanks to Peter Wood for producing the kick-ass original music for this podcast. Follow him on Twitter at TheLiminal and check out his website at petercwood.com. It goes without saying that booze is both delicious and tons of fun, but if you feel like it's starting to take over your life, help is available. U.S. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration has a free, confidential national helpline. It's available 24/7, 365 days a year for treatment referrals and information for individuals and families facing mental and/or substance use disorders. Help is only a phone call away at 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-4357.